I'm going to caveat this firstly. I think Philippa Langley is a fantastic historian who has drawn a lot of attention to medieval history, where particularly to a medieval period that hasn't had a lot of attention popularly. However, and I know everyone thought that however was going to come, I think a lot of these documents were lacking in a large amount of provenance, which would have helped us. Is this really rich?
Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of the Aspects of History Pod. I'm starting a series inviting other history podcasters on to have a chat about a particular story from the past. And today it's Jackson Van Uden, who runs the History with Jackson podcast. And we discuss the Princes in the Tower, the two sons of Edward IV, likely dispatched by their uncle, Richard III. You heard Jackson at the top there chatting about the recent Channel 4 documentary, which claims to have uncovered the truth. So Jackson and I have a chat about it. Plenty more great history to come. Please do share and rate the pod. It really helps us to grow. Links to everything we discuss are in the show notes. But until then, I'm going to hand you over to me chatting with Jackson. Jackson Van Uden, welcome to the podcast. And thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be on.
Well, Jackson, and so for listeners, Jackson runs his own podcast called History with Jackson. And I just thought I'd do a little mini series with a few podcasters who run history podcasts that look quite interesting. Jackson is one of them. And so Jackson's yours. How long has yours been running for? Quite a while, I think. Obviously, you've got plenty of episodes in there, haven't
Oh,
you?
Christ. It was 3 years on January the 1st. So it's gone through various iterations, but yeah, I've been History of Jackson's been around for 3 years, and I makes me feel old saying that now.
Splendid. I don't want to dwell on the woes of podcasters because the listeners will get very bored. But that's quite a lot of hard work in 3 years.
Quite a lot of books as well, which I'm sure you like that part of the job, getting free books. Unfortunately, I have very little room for them now, so. But that's probably one of the woes that I have trying to fit books into my shelves.
I don't really mind, but my wife does.
Yeah.
Right. So I the way for the listeners' sake, the way we were going to talk about this is I was going to cover a few of the episodes that Jackson's had that looked interesting to me, and then Jackson's going to pick out a few episodes that are interesting to him. And I wanted to talk about a few sort of topical issues. In particular, you do have quite a slant for medieval history, particularly around kings and queens, I've noticed.
I think for me, talking about kings and queens is, it's one of those things that listeners love. It's always something that people want to learn more about. There's more and more history coming out from a different slant that's not centered around the men of the period, which is really fascinating. But also, it's where I started off as a historian as well. I think a lot of us got interested in history through the medieval period, and then diverted across the different points based on our other interests, but it's always something I like returning to, and particularly the Crusades and the Wars of the Roses. I cannot get enough of the political and the military aspects of them.
Right, so I thought then we could cover a bit of the Princes in the Tower because
Oh,
you must have watched the documentary that
certainly
came.
did. Yeah.
So for listeners' sake, this is maybe we why don't we just dive in with this now?
I think that's a good place to start. I think that's a good place to start.
Okay, so this is quite a controversial topic. So for listeners who maybe aren't familiar, the Princes in the Tower are the two sons of Edward the Fourth, King Edward the Fourth, and their uncle was Richard the Third, and he Jackson, would you say this is a period of history? I think you've just said that this is an area you're most familiar with. Why don't you explain it for the listeners, and then we can dig into some of the controversy. But this is just a bit of familiarity for some of the listeners who maybe aren't aware as well.
Yeah, so I might steamroll through this quickly. So you've got a period of a lot of political turmoil in England where Henry VI, for all intents and purposes, is a pretty useless king. There's some issues there that means he can't rule properly, and you have a lot of usurpations, a lot of people trying to take the throne, and Edward IV is one of those people who takes the throne. And after a period of consolidation, him losing the throne and coming back again, he dies quite early. He dies in his 40s. And of course, after Henry VI, who came to the throne at think barely a year. No one in England particularly wants a child on the throne again. And Edward V was, he was a child. Richard III, Richard Duke of Gloucester, for some reason, there are a lot of different debates. Did he accidentally end up going down this route? Did he deliberately take the throne? But it is thought by some historians that Richard III had the two boys murdered, either with the Duke of Buckingham, either with Margaret Beaufort in conspiring to help or whatever, that he had the two boys, Edward V and Richard, Duke of York, I think he was. He had the boys murdered in the Tower and usurped the throne for himself.
Right, very well summed up. So, Jackson, first question I'm going to ask you is, and you've mentioned some historians believe that Richard III, wouldn't it be fair to say that the majority of historians come down on that side of things before I ask you what your view is?
Yeah, from what I've seen, I think the majority of historians believe that Richard had the boys murdered. It's quite a difficult one because a lot of these sources are based on you probably see in my slant now. A lot of these sources are based off what's come out of the Tudor court, what's come out of the court of Henry VII. Propaganda is a massive thing, and when you're reading sources which are paid for someone or by someone to create a narrative, you are going to naturally be reading propaganda that has permeated into an accepted perspective that Richard was the one who murdered the boys.
Ah, so you probably think he's maligned in this regard. You don't think he necessarily did murder them.
I personally think it's something. I think if they were murdered, I haven't seen enough evidence either way, to be honest. Just because there's a set of bones that are labelled the boys doesn't mean that they are, and even if we test them, and it's not them, and it opens so many more questions. I think if they were murdered, I think it was very much a situation that just arose, very much with a Thomas A. Beckett kind of style. Well, no one rid me of these troublesome kids, and something's happened. So I think it's more likely that they did die than they ran away. But for me, it's somewhat difficult to kind of weigh in firmly on either side and go, the boys are dead, Richard killed the boys, or Buckingham killed the boys, or both boys escaped and they went off to Europe and became the pretenders and so on. I'm more on the side that they perhaps died, but in a, well, no one rid me of these troublesome boys, and then suddenly, oh no, I've got to go away with this now and deal with it.
Yeah, interesting. I suspect it's highly likely to that Richard III did it, and I actually think he was right to. I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, I don't think it's a stain on his car. I mean, they're children, so obviously, I'm not saying that I approve of murdering kids. Just to be clear, listeners, but if you are a medieval king, or it would be just on the verge of the early modern period, but if you are, it's to all intents and purposes a kind of medieval period for the purposes of my argument at least. If you are trying to secure your throne and you've got two major threats who are in the direct line, even though you've argued that they are illegitimate, to me it's completely natural and the right thing to do as a monarch to do it. So I don't understand why people who are rather favorable to Richard III would view this as necessarily a negative thing, despite the fact that they are kids. Because I think this is good kingly, this is strong, not good, that's the wrong word, strong monarchical behavior.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Any other king that has had usurpation threats has removed that usurpation threat. Edward IV made the mistake the first time he came to the throne by not having Henry VI, or not finding Henry VI and having Henry VI killed. The second time when he came to the throne, Henry VI died of melancholy. There is blood on the hair that was tested within the grave or the coffin. So Edward IV, Richard's brother, dealt with a usurpation threat pretty solidly, if you ask me. And so have previous monarchs. So it's not out of character with the British monarchy or the English monarchy to remove a usurpation threat. I think it's just the issue that we're children. Like, King John gets a bad rap because he allegedly murdered his nephew, Arthur. So it's that I mean, there's plenty of other reasons why John's bad king, but it's I think it's that attachment to it being children.
Yeah, absolutely. And the new TV show puts forward four pieces of evidence. And I wondered whether you were, because at the end of it, I thought it was rather an iffy show, to be honest. And by the end, they seem to have Judge Rinder and Philippa Langley both seem to come to the conclusion that we've solved it, it's done. You know, the two boys escaped and became challengers, rivals to Richard III. But the four pieces of evidence that they present in this TV show, and listeners, I'll put a link in the show notes if you are able to watch it. Were you in any way convinced by the and I'll just list them out. So there's a receipt that's been found for an army and weapons for Edward V. There is an there are some archives in Austria that show marks on the body of Richard, Duke of York, that are the same as those as the challenger, the rival, the escaped boy, supposedly. There is a document, it's called the Gelder's Document, which is of Richard's biography. So this boy supposedly escapes and then recites his life, and this is shown as proof. And then finally, there is a receipt or a document promising 30,000 florins for Richard to challenge Henry VII, I think this is. So these are the four separate pieces of evidence. You in any way, does this make you agree with Philippa Langley that, you know, we've solved it, so we can all go home?
Yeah, I'm going to caveat this firstly. I think Philippa Langley is a fantastic historian who has drawn a lot of attention to medieval history, and particularly to a medieval period that hasn't had a lot of attention popularly. However, and I know everyone thought that however was going to come, I think a lot of these documents were lacking in a large amount of provenance, which would have helped us. Well, is this really Richard? Is this really happening here? You know, the reciting of the story of Richard. Okay, like I could sit down now and write a story and recite my life or recite and pretend to be someone else and be precise about it, and someone could go, oh, that looks very precise. That must be him. I don't necessarily agree with that. And it's equally as easy to turn up and say that you're someone who hasn't been seen for many years. But also, I think there was a lot of context missing from the debate. There was a lot put on Richard and Edward's sister, Margaret, which I think there was a lot of provenance missing there as well. Now, what was Margaret's motivation for supporting someone who might have been Richard? Well, Henry had killed her brother in battle. Henry had taken the throne from her family, who had taken the throne from another family. So I think the provenance that was missing from these documents didn't sway me at all, probably pushed me further in the way that I already am. And I think the missing context from the situation just sensationalized it all a bit, which, yes, it's the TV program, it's an hour and a half. I'll have to read the book. I haven't read the book yet, but yeah, it's probably made me. It's entrenched my views a bit more, that they were probably murdered than escaped to Europe.
Oh, that's interesting. So the documentary did the opposite of what it sought to do in your case.
I think I went into it with an open mind because I was fairly ambiguous about it. Like, oh, okay, might be. I'll listen to what Philippa has to say. She was fantastic with Richard III, but. Yeah, after looking at all those, what was on that documentary? I mean, I watched it with my parents and they were just like, can you shut up? So, yeah, I think it's kind of entrenched that worldview that I have about that particular situation.
Yeah, I found it interesting that at the end, and the two, Rinder and Langley, both sort of, it's clear, it's done. I thought that was just slightly ridiculous. But also, I think the evidence or the documents that they did find, I'd have no doubt that they were from the period. I think they had been dated, and they had a number of experts had come in and looked at it and agreed with them. It's just whether they're genuine rather than, you know,
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
agent.
it's like if you look at anything that Mancini writes from for Henry and Tudor, you if you take away the provenance, you're like, oh, okay, like Richard was a horrible king. And then if you add in, you know, Henry Tudor's court historian Mancini, you're like, oh, like I can understand now why that has that particular slant. So the missing provenance and missing context for a lot of that just, yeah, it did not help. And you can't solve that case at all. Like very much as who was Jack the Ripper. Yeah, we can have some idea of who he might have been, but until, you know, time travel's invented, we probably can't find out who murdered the boys or if the boys were murdered at all. So, yeah, it's a difficult one. And Channel 4 did a very good job of selling that one, to be honest. I've got to give props to Channel 4.
Do you know what I really liked about that documentary? It was the animations. I thought that was really the animations that sort of were telling the story of the two boys. It was actually really, I really liked it, the way they did that. I don't know if that's damning the documentary with faint praise, but that's what I liked about it.
I like the breadth of historians as well. Bring in, I liked seeing Nathan Amon on there. I liked seeing Matt Lewis in there. I think it gave, alongside those animations, which I'd like to see more of, I think it introduced us to far more historians who I think I'd like to see on telly a bit more as well.
I think what could have really improved it is if they'd had a program of about 45 minutes afterwards, and this is, you know, probably the world of history demanding what they're unlikely to get, but a 45 minute to an hour's chat between, you know, like a panel discussion, two historians, Philippa Langley being one of them and another, and then Nathan Amon and perhaps another historian on his side just thrashing it out. That I think that'd be quite interesting.
I would have watched that right after that as well. I think it would have helped contextualize a lot of the debate that Philippa had, or even if Channel 4 had said, well, we'll make a three-part series. I think that would have been quite nice as well. And I do feel bad for the Americans, because from what I've heard, the Americans have cut certain parts out of documentary to make it shorter. So I think we're very lucky to have had that full hour and a half, to be honest.
Yeah, it was longer than I expected it to be. Good stuff. So, okay. So, looking at your list of episodes that you've done, 3 years now, maybe this is a good time for you to reflect and have a. Are there any in particular that you're probably proudest of? This might help listeners of this podcast to see, you know, find a good episode to kick off with.
As I'm a scholar of, I also write as well. So, as I'm a scholar of totalitarianism and totalitarian regimes, I'm particularly interested in anything that has to do with Nazi Germany, Stalinist Russia, and China. Now, I don't often get the opportunity to do something like that because sometimes if you cover that, it's already been covered to death. So, you have to be very careful. But the episode that I did with Charles Spicer on Coffee of Hitler. For me, that was something that was I really, really enjoyed doing because I was able to not only, you know, read the book and ask some questions and discuss it, but I was able to use my own existing knowledge to talk about, you know, the different political leanings of Nazi Germany, different effects of totalitarian ideologies on Germany and how the British diplomats were talking and dealing with that. So I really enjoyed that episode, and it's one of my books of the year. Be honest, Coffee with Hitler is such a fantastic book. I think I read it all in an evening, just sitting there, just absolutely captured by the book and the topics within it. So Coffee with Hitler was one of my absolute favorites this year.
I've heard good things about it. So this is about certain British individuals who, I guess, were they trying to modify the Nazis in some way?
Yeah, so
Which.
they were part of that Anglo-German fellowship. Friendship group who were trying to encourage prior to the war, trying to encourage the British to interact with the Nazis to try and maintain peace in Europe, but also maintain those lines of communication. They facilitated David Lloyd George going over there and having a meeting with Hitler. They facilitated Neville Chamberlain going over there and having a meeting. So when you look at it on the surface, and you thought, oh, Britain didn't do enough. But when you look in the background, there are individuals there trying to maintain peace. It's one of those hidden histories which is, I think, need to be out there a bit more.
Yeah, because I think It's interesting you say that because the British, when one thinks of the Nazis and Brits, it's obviously those awful Mitford sisters. And then there are, various aristocrats who show a lot of sympathy and interest in the Nazis as well. I guess this is another side of British involvement in the rise of the Nazis and the Nazis in power.
Yeah, it definitely presents pro-German ideas, but not particularly pro-Nazi ideas. So I think we've all got into that kind of viewpoint that anyone who was pro-Germany or pro-peace within or prior to World War II was a Nazi. Not everyone who wanted peace and was pro, interaction with Germany was a Nazi. And I think it's exposed that narrative a little bit more, which I think it's been unfair to taint everyone with the same brush and just go, well, everyone who liked Germany was a Nazi, when it obviously wasn't. And I think it gives a lot, it rings true for some things today as well, where you look at certain regimes and people who are pro bringing certain regimes into the international political arena today and everyone tainting them with the same brush. Meanwhile, you say actually they're just pro this country and these people, not pro the regime.
It's that nuance of history, isn't it? I mean, because we know that the Second World War began in 1939 and we had the Holocaust. I mean, we've got that knowledge. Of course, they didn't know that prior. And World War One had been so catastrophic that the idea of preventing war was, it wasn't exactly a niche belief. I mean, Winston Churchill was in the minority, really, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I think we all tend to, I think World War II has changed our attitude towards war and peace, where after World War I it was never again, we're not doing that again, try and search for any alternatives towards peace. And I think now we perhaps post World War II we perhaps have a different slant, where if you can't make sure there's peace through peaceful methods, we still have these forces to ensure that things don't get as bad as that again.
I was looking at some of the episodes that you've done, and one particular sprung out was with Simon Elliott, who did a Alexander the Great versus Julius Caesar discussion. And well, listeners will know that Alexander the Great, I haven't actually done an episode on Alexander, but he looms large. He's on the logo. I'm a huge admirer of Alexander. But yeah, that was one episode that particularly sprung out. And Simon Elliott is a hugely enthusiastic historian of the ancient world, isn't he?
I love Simon, as you've probably looked through the episode list. Simon has come onto the podcast more than anyone else. I think he's come on 4 or 5 times now, and a lot of my knowledge of the medieval world has come from Simon. But that episode was the first time I've worked with Simon, and to compare Caesar and Alexander, which I'd previously never touched upon in my academic history life at all. It was fascinating because I learned so much about the period and I learned so much about their military tactics. It was 2 years ago now, so it is very faint memories for me now. But I didn't realize how much the ancient world can inform my understanding of not only my own work, but inform my understanding of other people's work as well. Yeah, it helped me contextualize what's happening in the periods, what's happening, post-Rome. So a lot of those medieval ideas that I discussed with, Ashley Mantle, Steve Tipple, I'm seeing motifs repeating from the Roman period and from Alexander's Macedonian Empire, which is actually really fun to kind of touch upon those themes a bit more. And then when I talk to Simon again, I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. I saw this in this episode. So yeah, it's always great to work with Simon and work on from that moment.
Yeah, the ancient world is something that I'm always keen on covering that kind of period. I did one that I was hugely excited about to talk to an academic called James Romm, who is American historian and very interested in the period after the death of Alexander. And I was so excited. And this I'm going to admonish my own listeners now. And well, those that listened, I won't admonish, but those that didn't, I will, because I thought, oh, this is the best one I've ever done. I loved it. And the listener numbers were not the same as, I don't know, anything on Nazi Germany or some of the other episodes I've done. I find it hugely unpredictable as to which will do well and which won't.
Yeah, that's one of those ones that you have an episode where you're like, I love this topic. I'm so well prepared. I've done great questions. And everyone else is like, no, I want to listen to World War II. So I understand your pain on that. But yeah, I think that's the one thing that about history podcasting that I've like I do like looking at my figures. We all like looking at our figures, but I think it's one thing that I've quite liked doing this year is looking at my figures, experimenting with topics to see what people want to listen to. And at the end of the day, you just go, you know what? People aren't going to listen to it, but at least I've got that content out there. And you know, in 5 years' time, like I've had this year, before no one listened to Roman content, and then the Roman Empire became a trending topic on TikTok, and then all my Roman content ended up getting more plays within a few weeks. So I was like, oh, all right. So at least you have a body of content there for people to touch on when Alexander the Great becomes a trending topic.
Indeed, it will happen. It will happen. It will happen. All right, Jackson. I know we'd mentioned talking about interesting historical topics. Is there anything that particularly you wanted to talk about?
I think at the moment, you know, discussing there's two looming large, and I think you've covered them quite a bit without getting into all the discussions about today, but Russia, China, and the Middle East, you've seemed to have covered it quite a lot on aspects of history. Why have you decided to take those stances and cover those regions?
Well, I'm very interested in current affairs, and so that's the main reason, really. And one can always find a historical narrative behind what's happening today. I think sometimes that's maybe overplayed, but I think also if we take the war in Ukraine as an example, and I've had a number of Serhii Plokhii's episodes that actually had quite a big impact on me. It's because it's an existential conflict. This is a totalitarian state, to all intents and purposes, invading not a perfect democracy, but a democracy nonetheless. And so that, that's to me was a historic moment. Plus, the fact that aspects of history is called aspects of history means I've got quite a bit of flexibility and can get away with that kind of thing. So yeah, that's. In particular for the war in Ukraine, just because it has that sort of historical significance. And then with we I covered Israel-Palestine with a interesting academic, Italian based in America, and that did really well actually, inevitably, I suppose. But I was very nervous about it because one doesn't want to present too lopsided a view. I'm sure you appreciate that. And I just wanted to give some listeners a little bit of basic background as to we are where we are. So we went up to the 1967 war. And it was really because, again, this I think the attacks on October the 7th were so horrific. And then the extraordinary response from the Israeli military since means that it's been dominating our newspapers, and because of the historical aspect, it seemed to me to be a kind of natural episode to put in there, really.
I mean, certainly agree with your assessment that Russia is totalitarian and the brutality of those attacks and the responses. Do you then see giving context and background as part of your duty as a historian and a historical content creator?
I suppose so. My first duty is to try and help historians get their voice out. And equally, alongside, is to make an entertaining episode for the listeners. So, I mean, if I really wanted to do what I want the whole time, maybe I would be doing more stuff on, I don't know, Israel-Palestine. I think I've done a bit of overkill on the Ridley Scott Napoleon film. I suspect the listeners might be getting a little bit sick of us going on about the Ridley Scott film. It's just because it was, him talking about his comments on historians, I found really quite entertaining. I'd find it difficult to get upset by that kind of stuff. I found it quite amusing. And so when I have a historian on or an author, a historical fiction author, I'm very keen to see what they think. But a duty, I suppose so, but not that would probably be slightly too, I don't want to sound like I'm too pompous. Ultimately, these podcasts are a bit of fun and entertainment, and I do take a slightly, I'm not deadly serious on all my episodes, although I was for Israel Palestine.
No, I can understand that. First, I fully agree with getting a historian's voice out there. It's something that I'm particularly keen on and passionate about as well. But it's like you said, it's that fine line of being entertaining, educating, but also trying to fit the moment. Like you said about Napoleon and all these conflicts, everyone's creating content about them. It's sometimes it's hard to sit in that sound and really educate, but make a difference and at points. So taking that entertaining stand, I think it's a key way of where you do it, and I quite like that.
Well, there's a particular historian who I have on quite regularly called Gordon Corrigan. And Gordon's just brilliant. He's hilarious. He doesn't care that it's 2024. And he's just a voice from a like a different period. And I hope he wouldn't mind me saying that, but he's hugely knowledgeable on military history. But he's very funny with it. And so I've had him on to talk about. I've got some French listeners, dwindling French listeners, because we've covered Crecy, Poitiers, Waterloo, and then I've started doing a Great British Commanders series, which Gordon is an ever-present. So if listeners are ever worried that Gordon won't be on one of those episodes, that's not going to be the case. He'll be on all of them, and he's just so amusing to listen to, and he always has something interesting to say. He's not conformist. So, for example, Montgomery, the British general during the Second World War, Gordon doesn't rate him in any way, really. And that's always quite refreshing to hear. So, that's a little sort of warm up for the listeners, because we're going to be doing our Great British Series Commanders continues with the also rans of the 20th century. So, we're going to do World War II also rans, because Slim was our top commander for the British commander for the Second World War. And Gordon covers all the also rans, and he really does stick the knife in de Montgomery.
No, I'll look forward to listening. But how do you choose those topics then to discuss different areas? Because I think it's something that we don't, as historical content creators, we don't often talk about how we choose what we talk about. So how do you make those decisions to create that?
Well, I thought that, okay, if we take that series, do something on the Great British Commanders, I thought it might be popular. So it also coincided with the publication of Slim's short stories that he'd written. There's a series of three short stories, which I'd recommend. And so I thought, oh, well, what better way to promote Slim, if he's not around to promote himself, is to get his biographer on, Anne Gordon, who served in the same regiment as Slim, to have a chat about him as a commander. And it did really well. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll just carry it on. And so I named it in that way. I thought, okay, if I name it like that, then it'll look like there are more coming. And it did well. So I just thought, oh, we'll keep on going. So I think we're going to keep on going down to the medieval period. We've started Second World War. We'll go through the Victorian era. We'll go, Napoleonic Wars. We'll go down to Seven Years' War. We'll keep on going, I think. And Gordon will be there for all of it, because Gordon can cover it. If it's military history, Gordon's up for it.
It's always nice when you have a guest like that you can use and go back to. I think, yeah, the
Oh, I
way that
don't
you.
use him. Don't Jackson, that's an
Oh,
outrageous slur.
sorry. Yeah. But, yeah, you got me there. Yeah.
I do slightly use him. But he like we have a good we have a good, enjoyable chat. We
It's mutually beneficial. Listen.
exactly.
Yeah, I think it's a different. I think it's a slightly different approach, really, because I tend to. Because a lot of my work is done on interviewing historians on their books, and I tend to get requests or get requests from publishers and sift through those to see what I find interesting, what might hit those out, like, again with the algorithms. But everyone's creating stuff about what's happening in the moment, and sometimes I'm trying to challenge that and go somewhere else and give another event so that people have a relief from what's happening or add something that's slightly different from the general view, like with Uncrowned or an episode that I've got coming up on powerful medieval women, decentralizing the narrative from people who are in power or where the narrative's mainly been around powerful men, centering it around, who were these women actually without the con like trying to take away the context of their husbands or their children, or looking at things in a slightly different way. I think it expands what you can understand about history, and expands history for people who aren't necessarily in touch with up-to-date historical research.
Good stuff. So you've got that coming up then. What else have you got coming up that you're looking forward to?
Oh, I've got a stack of books that I need to be reading, but I'm looking forward to talking to Steve about the Crusaders again. I love
Yes, he's
working with.
just written the Templars.
Yes, that is a fantastic book. That is an absolutely fantastic book. So I've read that one. I've done an episode with Steve on that, and then I will be working with Steve again this year on his two previous books about Crusader armies and Crusader strategies. So I'm looking forward to diving into that, and I'm looking forward to covering some festivals as well through the podcast. So next weekend, I'm covering the Catherine of Aragon Festival, doing
Is that
some
in
live podcasts.
Spain?
No, it's unfortunately it's in Peterborough. No,
Peterborough.
yeah, not quite as sunny, not quite as warm, and the food's not quite as good.
Well, she
But
spent most of her life here, so I suppose that's.
yeah, part of it. But yeah, it'll be interesting to do some live podcasting again. I really enjoy doing live podcasting, so
Yeah,
that'll be pretty fun.
that's really interesting. Yeah, I like your little snippets. They're really good, like sort of 10 minutes quick chats. And a festival dedicated to Catherine of Aragon.
Yes, an entire festival dedicated to Catherine of Aragon's life. So there are religious ceremonies, there are Catholic ceremonies, there are reenactors reenacting Tudor courts when Catherine would have been there. There are Tudor walks and tours of Peterborough. So it's going to be a really, really exciting event. And to look at the history of my hometown through the context of someone who is so immensely popular at the moment, is going to be really quite fun to do, actually. So I'm looking forward to doing that and walking around with my microphone and probably my winter coat to make sure I'm warm enough.
Well, she was very hard done by, so I think that's an absolutely wonderful festival to have, that so many hundreds of years after her death, that she is commemorated after being treated so badly by Henry VIII.
I totally agree that she was badly, badly sidelined. Probably it was probably emotional abuse as well at some point. So I'm very happy to do my little bit to maintain Catherine's memory and pay a little bit of homage to her. But what are you excited for aspects of history this year? Because it's a big year.
Well, we're launching a new podcast, and so there'll be more on this soon for listeners, but we're launching a new podcast on the 1st of February, which is the Spy Masters, which is a podcast on spies. And so that'll be exciting, but that's going to be run by Antonia Senior, who's the historical fiction reviewer for The Times. So she's launching that channel. For aspects of history, I've got a few episodes coming up. Well, obviously, I've mentioned the Great British Commander series. I'm looking to, I've got a conversation on Checkpoint Charlie and East Berlin. I've got the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya. That's very interesting. That is a, I think there's a lot more to, I've received this book written by Nicholas Rankin. It's fascinating. Sort of personal history alongside the Mau Mau uprising, which was a, for listeners who aren't familiar, it was in colonial Kenya, Kenya as it was called in those days, a uprising, brutal uprising, and then brutally put down by the British. So it's a one of those nasty little wars where no one comes out of it looking well. And so that's particularly interesting. And I've got a, I'm just trying to think what else I've got. I must have a lot more, which my momentarily gone blank. Oh yes, we're going to be doing a limited series for authors to dive into their books. So we'll have three or four episodes where we'll take a story from history and we'll cover it in great detail. So that'll be something that is more of a deep dive than my sort of singular episodes that I do.
I'm really looking forward to those deep dives. But I saw that when I saw that Spy Masters announcement come up on my social media, I was like, wow, I need to listen to that. That just looked absolutely fascinating. So it's a bit of a growth there for aspects of history, which is it sounds fun.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it goes. But Antonia is, so she herself is working on a book on the Cambridge spy ring, Kim Philby and all that. And she's interviewing some really interesting authors. In particular, she's interviewing David McCloskey, who's this new novelist who was a former CIA officer. and he's written novels. And I, having spoken to Antonia, she tells me that he's been quite willing to, I don't think betraying secrets, I probably shouldn't say that, but he's been quite interesting, I'll say. And then General David Petraeus, who is the US Army general who was the director of the CIA for a year. And so that's going to be, I think, quite interesting. And one wonders whether he'll reveal any state secrets on that episode.
And if you miraculously disappear, then I know what's happened. So that's.
Exactly. Jackson, look, this has been fantastic. Thank you very much.
That's all right. And I've got one final
Oh,
fun question
yes.
for you,
Oh,
actually.
God.
So this is something that I do at the History of Jackson podcast every single episode without fail. You know what? You've covered so much and you've discussed some of it that you've already touched on today. But what has been your favorite piece of history across your life as a historian, in school, university? What has been your favorite piece of history that you have looked at, featured, written about, read?
I would say then I, this is a sort of an emotional thing where I used to read Sharp when I was about 10. I first started reading Sharp when I was about 10 or 11, and I just obsessed with it. And it got me into the whole period, Napoleonic period, you know, not only the history, but also some of the writing, Thackeray's Vanity Fair, for example. And the Battle of Waterloo. So I would probably say, and that whole Napoleonic period, I'm fascinated by.
I like that. I always like the emotional, personal answers to those questions because I think it shows historians more off as people instead of just what people think we are. We're just hermits sitting in our offices writing books and writing articles and not interacting. So I like that. So thank you very much.
Well, historical fiction was a real. We promote historical fiction authors as well. We love historical fiction and aspects of history. And when you're at a boarding school and you're young, that's the one of the few things that gives you a bit of escapism. So yeah, very much so.
I like that. So thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that.
No probs. Great. So we're done. There are no more special questions.
I think that was our that was our final fun question. So yeah, thank you very
Brilliant.
much.
Jackson, thanks so much.
And thank you very much for having me. And thank you for coming on mine as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. We both thank each other for being on
Yeah.
each other's podcasts. Doubled up. Nice one. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you check out Jackson's pod. But until then, thank you and good night.